Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Joshua chapter 23. I'm going to cover verses 1 through 16, the entire chapter. I'm going to call this chapter Joshua's final charge to Israel. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 22, we see the eastern tribes have returned home to the east, leaving the other 9.5 tribes on the west. And in the previous chapters before that, we see all of the land divvied up, distributed. 5 tribes at Gilgal, 7 tribes had their distribution done at Shiloh, and plus the Levites, they had their distribution done at Shiloh, and everything's taken care of. And so Joshua, as he is preparing to die, wants to give a farewell speech to the leaders of Israel. So we start in Joshua 23, verses 1 through 5. Now it came about after many days when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies on every side, and Joshua was old, advanced in years, that Joshua called for all Israel, for their elders and their heads and their judges and their officers, and said to them, I am old, advanced in years, and you have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is he who has been fighting for you. See, I have apportioned to you these nations which remain as an inheritance for your tribes, with all the nations which I have cut off, from the Jordan even to the great sea toward the setting of the sun. The Lord your God, he will thrust them out from before you and drive them from before you, and you will possess their land, just as the Lord your God promised you. Now, in verse 1, it says, it came about after many days that all this happened. So, when is this? Adam Clark says it's the 110th year of Joshua's life, which is the last year. Clark says it's about 13 or 14 years after the conquest of Canaan. Remember, if Joshua crossed the Jordan River in 1406 B.C., and then it took him 7 years to conquer the land, that seven-year number is pretty firm, that puts him about 1399, and then we've got about 6 or 7 years after that to where we are now, according to Clark. Jameson Fawcett Brown said it was 14 years after, so just roughly 13 or 14 years after the conquest of Canaan, which would make it about 20 or 21 years after the entry into Canaan. So this is about 7 years after the division of the land among the tribes, assuming that Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown have estimated the time correctly. But at any rate, whenever it was when the Lord had given rest to Israel. There's that famous word, rest. That means no more battles, peace, perfect type for the antitype of the rest of Christians in the Church of Jesus Christ in the kingdom of God, as we have seen in Hebrews chapter 4. Let us enter that rest. Here's what Gill says about the rest. Quote, the greatest part of the land of Canaan was subdued, the whole divided by lot to the tribes of Israel, and they quietly settled in the respective portions assigned them, the Canaanites that remained giving them no disturbance. That's because they had rest. In which state of rest and peace they had now been for some years, and this may be reasonably supposed to be the last year of the life of Joshua, as John Gill says. So he thought it was the last year of Joshua, so does Clark, and I assume they're right, because that's perfectly reasonable, because he's about to give his farewell speech. Now in the end of verse 1, the text says that Joshua was old, advanced in years. John Gill says about this, quote, he says that Joshua was, quote, or Joshua, quote, became feeble and decrepit, and greatly declined, for though he was 10 years younger than Moses when he died, yet not so vigorous, strong, and robust as he, but was pressed and bore down with the infirmities of age. Well, Joshua spent all his life fighting military battles. He was a general, above all else. Moses didn't fight battles. That might have had something to do with pressing down, but I don't think so. I think it's just random. It's genes. I wish I could remember the name of that general in ancient history who disappeared in Egypt. He was 80-something years old. Can't remember his name, but he was really interesting because he just disappeared. He's 80 years old fighting a battle at 80 in front of a horse, and he ended up dying in the desert. At any rate, Joshua is old. He calls all the leaders together. Where? Well, it could be Timnath-Serah, which was his allotted hometown. And the argument for that is Joshua was old and infirm and not able to go elsewhere. But I think it's more probably Shechem, which is 10 miles north of Shiloh, where we last left Joshua and the leaders, because they afterwards convened at Shechem, Joshua and the leaders. We see in Joshua 24, verse 1, the next chapter. Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, and called for the elders of Israel and for their heads and their judges and their officers, and they presented themselves before God. So let's assume they're at Shechem. He calls all Israel to himself. Now, that probably does not mean all the males. You're talking about, what, 600,000 or so? More than that? No. It's the representatives only, which are mentioned here, elders, heads, judges, and officers. Now, the elders would be the head of a tribe. The heads were probably heads of a family. Tribes were divided into families, like Levi had Kohath, Gershon, and Merari, three families in one tribe. So heads were still pretty important. They're heads of a family. And then the judges were those, whoever they were, who were interpreted and decided according to the law, probably legal scholars. And then officers were probably those who executed the decision of the judges. All that political stuff doesn't really matter. The point is he had all the big shots of Israel together to have this formal ceremony of farewell. In verse 3, he says, "And you have seen all that the Lord your God has done." The Lord your God has done. And before he says that, Joshua says, "I am old, advanced in years," which we already knew that, but he repeats it to the elders. Why did he do that? Well, perhaps to prepare them that he's about to die. He wants to give them advice and instructions before he dies. It could be he said that to give them more, to encourage them to more greatly respect and reverence him, because he's an old man with white hair. You're supposed to reverence people like that, unless you live in America. The other day, the beloved Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was complaining about somebody in her political party named James Carville, who's bald-headed and fairly old. And Mr. Carville was saying that the extreme left of his party need to go to a woke detox center. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says, woke, by the way, is a word that only old people use. You know, the ultimate diss. Hey, boomer, you don't know what you're talking about because you're old. Well, that ain't the way it was back in Israel's time. And maybe he's mentioning that to get people to reverence him. I don't think so. I think he just mentioned that he was old to prime them for the fact that he's about to die. And he wants to excite attention to what he's about to say. Now, he mentions in verse 3, Joshua does, he said, "The Lord has done to all these nations because of you. You've seen it all, what the Lord has done. The Lord your God is he who has been fighting for you." Notice he doesn't take credit for himself. He's very modest. As Adam Clark says, quote, "There is much both of piety and modesty in this address. It was natural for the Israelites to look on their veteran, worn-out general who had led them on from conquest to conquest with profound respect, and to be ready to say, had we not had such a commander, we had never got possession of this good land." Joshua corrects this opinion and shows them that all their enemies had been defeated because the Lord their God had fought for them, that the battle was the Lord's and not his, and that God alone should have the glory. The application point for that is very easy. You do great things for God, you better give God the glory and not take it for yourself. I think that's a no-brainer. Now in verse 4, Joshua says, "See, I have apportioned to you," he's talking to the leaders of Israel, "I have apportioned to you these nations which remain as an inheritance for your tribes." How did the nations remain? I thought Joshua had already conquered the land. Well, the land was allotted, but the Canaanites were not driven out of the land yet. Remember, the Israelites didn't have enough population to populate every Canaanite city in Israel. That was impossible. If they'd tried to do it too quickly, they would have destroyed the underlying economy and they would have starved to death. Well, anyway, in verse 4, we see two designations of Canaanites, some who remain and some who were cut off. Now, those who were cut off were those who were conquered by the sword of Joshua. The men killed, the women and children may be killed, maybe not, depending on how we interpret certain texts, but the point is that the cities were wiped out and then populated by Israelites. Those were the cities that were cut off, but there were other cities where Canaanites remained in the cities that were paying tribute to Joshua, and the land was allotted to the Israelites to let them, on their own motions, each tribe, to conquer these allotted lands and then to drive the Canaanites out. But they hadn't been driven out yet. And so they remain. And so in verse 4, we see these two big categories of Canaanites. "I have apportioned to you these nations which remain with all the nations which I have cut off." That's in verse 4. The apportionment was done over all the Canaanites, but there was a distinction amongst the apportioned land between the Canaanites who remain and those who are cut off. "From the Jordan even to the Great Sea," that's the Mediterranean Sea, "toward the setting of the sun." Mediterranean Sea was to the west where the sun set. Verse 5, "The Lord your God, he will thrust them out before you and drive them out before you, and you will possess the land, just as the Lord your God has promised you." Now, when he says you will possess the land, of course, this is conditioned on their obedience, and there was a lot of disobedience in the history of Israel. So they made progress toward possessing the land during their history, and then they had it taken away from them sometimes because of their disobedience. Well, when was it all possessed? Well, let's look at the first stage in Joshua 21, which is a couple of chapters ago. We read in Joshua 21:43, "So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their fathers, and they took possession of it and settled there." Now, the land which he had promised to give all their fathers was described in Genesis 15:18. "On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, I give this land to your offspring from the brook of Egypt," that's the Wadi El Arish, the border of Egypt, in the southwest, "to the Euphrates River," which is the border of Syria, all the way up to the northeast. Now, all that land had not been possessed yet at the time of when Joshua said that. When he said that in Joshua 21:43, "So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their fathers, and they took possession of it and settled there." It says all the land. Of course, all can mean much of the land, but it doesn't matter if they didn't completely take possession of the land in Joshua 21:43. By the time we get to the time of Solomon, who's about 1000 BC or so, 1 Kings 4:21, about 300-400 years later, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt, from the northeast in Syria at the Euphrates all the way down to the southwest at the border of Egypt. That's exactly what had been promised to Abraham in the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 15. And so Joshua was entirely right. God will give them possession of the land. Now, since we clearly see in 1 Kings 4:21 that Solomon had possession of the land, just as was promised to Abram in Genesis 15, so the promised land, the land that was promised to Abraham, was fulfilled in the time of Solomon. I'm going to ask you a theological question. Since the land was fully possessed by the time of Solomon, is there room for a future possession? Hasn't the promise been fulfilled already? So why are we looking for something in the future? For example, the 1948 geopolitical kingdom of Israel on the western shores of the Mediterranean? Or maybe some future Jewish millennium? Of course, I'm referring to dispensationalist hot-button topics. These verses are an embarrassment to dispensationalists, and that's why I like these verses, because I'm not a dispensationalist. But of course, dispensationalists have got an answer for this. Of course they do. They say that Solomon didn't fully possess the land when Joshua said here in Joshua 23, verse 5, "You will possess the land." It hadn't happened in the time of Solomon. So dispensationalists would say. They say it'll happen in the future Jewish millennium, or maybe they'll say in Israel's time, 1948. I'm not really sure. I'm not an expert on dispensationalism, and maybe they split on that, but the point is they will not say that the land promise has already been fulfilled, at least the old-timey dispensationalists. Maybe the progressive dispensationalists might agree with me here. I don't know. But what they say is Solomon didn't possess the land because the conquered peoples were paying tribute to him. They were not, their cities were not possessed by Jewish colonists. They were living in their cities and paying tribute. Well, and so goes the argument, therefore they cannot be said to possess the land because they were merely paying, the Israelites cannot be said to possess the land because they were merely receiving tribute for some of the land. My answer to that is, how many British people lived in America pre-Revolutionary War? Not many. It was mostly American colonists. Can we thus say that Britain didn't possess the colonies because they didn't have anybody living there, but the colonies were paying tribute, you know, taxation without representation? It's a good analogy, I think. Well, of course Britain possessed the colonies. So that is a quibble, in my humble opinion, and I think that dispensationalism stands refuted by these verses, 1 Kings 4:21. The promised land has been occupied. Joshua predicts it here in verse 5. We're going out of Joshua 23, verses 6, 7, and 8. Joshua continues giving his speech to the leaders. He says, "Be very firm then to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, so that you may not turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left, so that you will not associate with these nations, these which remain among you, or mention the name of their gods, or make anyone swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them. But you are to cling to the Lord your God, as you have done to this day." Verse 6 says, "Be very firm." The King James says, "Be very courageous." Adam Clark comments, quote, "It requires no small courage to keep a sound creed in the midst of scoffers, and not less to maintain a godly practice among the profane and profligate." I can think of Lot down there in Sodom trying to keep a sound creed in the midst of scoffers. It's not easy. I spent my whole professional life in the midst of scoffers in the university, in American universities, and in Chinese universities for that matter. And I'm telling you, the official line was not pro-Christian. Of course not. And you have got to be very, very careful in that environment not to get yourself in trouble, not to get somebody else in trouble. At the same time, wondering whether you're being so safe that you're not spreading the gospel. I eventually got caught for having Christian meetings in China. And I say, well, okay, fine. They caught me. They kicked me out of the university and I lost my job. So what? It was great, a great privilege to see people come to Christ in the belly of the beast. We also notice here that Joshua is so concerned about association with idolaters. And to me, that is the hardest thing. Like in pagan, idolatrous America, you got kids, they're totally bombarded by the culture. They're going to be affected by it. And then they marry a non-Christian. Oh my gosh, you have just set, your family has been set up for crapola for the rest of your life. And Joshua knew this. God knew this. He knew that the eternal temptation would be for the Israelites to turn to idols. And that's why constantly in the Torah, and now here in Joshua, constantly the Israelites are exhorted to stay away from the idolaters. Do not marry them, for example. Here it says don't associate with them. Well, what does associate mean? John Gill says, quote, not to converse freely and familiarly, nor to carry on trade and commerce with them, nor enter into any alliances or marriages with them, and not even attend any of their feasts, and especially the idolatrous ones. Well, now, of course, the degrees of separation is always a contentious matter in the body of Christ. The fundamentalists are extreme on that, and these wussy-pussy emerging church people are on the other extreme. We've got to go down into the whorehouse and evangelize the prostitutes. Actually, I'm not against that, as long as you don't participate in their services. But you see what I mean. And I wonder whether Gil might be a little bit tight here not to carry on trade and commerce. How can you live in the land and not do business? Thomas Sowell, the famous conservative black economist, used to say that people who hate each other will trade. He mentioned the classic case in New Orleans in the colonial period. He said that the French and the English who hated each other's guts and would have nothing to do with each other, but every Friday they would come out and have a trade fair right there in the middle of the city, and they would trade, and then they'd go back to hating each other in their own ethnic conclaves. So I remember when a bunch of Yankees hated the Southerners during the American Civil War, they needed cotton, and boy, they would buy cotton from Southern plantations, and Lincoln would be so mad about that, and the Northern generals would be so mad, but people going to trade. So I'm not sure Gill was right about that, but I'm sure what he was right about, though, was don't make any alliances or marriages. Don't attend their idol feasts. Well, that ought to be obvious. The whole point is to stay away from pagans. Don't assimilate. Verse 7 says, don't even mention the name of their gods. Obviously, you don't worship the gods, but don't even talk about them. Not in common conversation, not with respect to religious matters. Don't speak of the idols with reverence. Don't speak of them with respect. They should be treated with contempt. They deserve contempt. They should be called names like, quote, dunghill gods, which they are. I don't have the site, but they're called things like that in the scriptures. That'd be a good Bible study. What were idols called in the Old Testament? Dunghill gods. Don't give them any respect. Joshua says in verse 8, but you're to cling to the Lord your God as you have done to this day. Now, what does that mean? It refers to the time since they came into Canaan until the time Joshua was speaking. No trouble with idols. They had big trouble with the idols of Baal Peor right before they crossed the Jordan. And, of course, they had trouble with idols, on and on and on afterwards. But during this blessed time that Joshua is ruling, no idols. And so he says, hey, he gives them credit. To this day, you have clung to the Lord your God. And, of course, clinging to the Lord your God means you worship him at the tabernacle in the right way, and you don't follow idols. We go now to Joshua 23, verses 9 through 11. Joshua continues his speech to the leaders of Israel, and he says this, for the Lord has driven out great and strong nations from before you, and as for you, no man has stood before you to this day. One of your men puts to flight 1,000, for the Lord your God is he who fights for you, just as he promised you. So take diligent heed to yourselves to love the Lord your God. Now, the strong nations of the Canaanites were strong. Why? Because they were numerous. Some of them were giants. All of them dwelt in fortified cities with walls, most of them. They all had large armies. Some of them even had chariots of iron. And the Israelites had whooped them all. So Joshua recounts all what the Lord had done. He says, for the Lord has driven them out. He didn't say, I did it. He said, the Lord did it. And God fights for the Israelites just as God had promised them. Where did God promise them this? Deuteronomy 1:30, the Lord your God who goes before you will himself fight on your behalf, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. He will fight for you. Deuteronomy 3:22, do not fear them, for the Lord your God is the one fighting for you. It reminds me of that verse, what is it in Romans, where Paul says, if the Lord is with you, who can be against you? If the Lord is on your side, big if there, he's got to be on your side. But if he is, he'll fight for you. He's got your back as a Christian. Just as the Lord promised. Well, when did the Lord promise that? Deuteronomy 11:25, no man will be able to stand before you. The Lord your God will lay the dread of you and the fear of you on all the land on which you set foot, as he has spoken to you. That was back in Deuteronomy. And that's exactly what happened. Joshua 1:5, no man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. That's just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. So God had constantly given the Israelites encouragement, and his promises came to pass. And folks, oh, what an application this is. The Christian life is so full of obstacles and enemies and problems and trials and afflictions and pains. But God himself will overcome them all if you let him fight for you. We go now to Joshua 23, verses 12 through 16, and we'll finish up this short chapter. For if you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, Joshua continues, these which remain among you, and if you intermarry with them so that you associate with them and they with you, know with certainty that the Lord your God will not continue to drive these nations out from before you. But they will be a snare and a trap to you, and a whip on your sides and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you. Now behold, today I am going the way of all the earth, i.e. he's going to die, and you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed. All have been fulfilled for you. Not one of them, not one of these good words has failed. It shall come about that just as all the good words which the Lord your God spoke to you have come upon you, so the Lord will bring upon you all the threats, until he has destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you. Sometimes I think that Moses and Joshua treated the Israelites like children. A lot of stick and a lot of carrot, like the famous Deuteronomy 27 and 28 curses and blessings from Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. A lot of carrot. Oh, good things will happen if you obey. And then a lot of stick. But if you don't, hemorrhoids, scabies, wasting diseases, fever, boils. The sky will turn to brass. No rain for your crops. Back to Joshua here, verse 16. As he finishes off his speech, when you, talking to the leaders of Israel, when you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, then the anger of the Lord will burn against you, and you will perish quickly from off the good land which he has given you. Now here we see a combination of blessings and promises. You're going to possess the land, or you're going to get kicked off the land. Basically, the idea is if you obey, you will possess the land. If you disobey, you're going to get your cattywampuses pushed off the land. Kicked out of the land. Well, let's go back to verse 12. Joshua said this, if you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, to the Canaanites, those which remain among you. Remember, we said there's two types of Canaanite cities, those that were taken and populated by the Israelites and their military wiped out, or cities that were not yet taken. And the cities that were not yet taken were mostly paying tribute to Joshua. I assume there might have been some other cities where we were not even paying tribute, but they hadn't been conquered yet. They weren't going to get together in a military fashion and threaten anybody. So maybe they were just living to themselves, not paying tribute. But anyway, those are the cities that remain. The population is still there. And so Joshua says, don't intermarry with them so that you associate with them. And again, I think that's what associate means. It basically means to intermarry with them. Gil mentioned don't even trade with them. I don't think so. It means don't intermarry with them. Joshua predicts that they will become a snare and a trap to you, these pagan nations. Exodus 23:33 says the same thing. They shall not live in your land because they will make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Deuteronomy 7:16, you shall consume all the peoples whom the Lord your God will deliver to you. Your eye shall not pity them, nor shall you serve their gods, for that would be a snare to you. Those idolaters would trap the Israelites. That's why they had to be wiped out. Of course, that was just because they were sinning against the Almighty God, and they got wiped out. Now, in verse 13, Joshua says that these Canaanites, if you disobey, well, they will become a whip to your sides and thorns to your eyes. It's interesting that Moses had said something similar, but not quite as elevated. He said in Numbers 33, verse 55, "But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come about that those whom you let remain of them will become as pricks in your eyes and as thorns in your sides." Pricks in your eyes, says Moses. Joshua says thorns in your eyes. Moses says that the Canaanites will be thorns in your sides, and Joshua says they'll be whips on your side. So he's up in the ante a little bit here from what Moses had said. Now in verse 13, Joshua says that the snare, the Canaanites, the idolaters, who will be whips to your sides and thorns in your eyes, will keep whipping and sticking until you perish from off this good land. Well, that actually happened. Let me give you some times the Israelites perished from the good land. How about in the times of the judges before the land had been fully conquered under Solomon? A lot of the Israelites died in battles with the Canaanites. They didn't totally perish because they still had their land, but they suffered some setbacks. Let's put it that way. And there was a lot of famine. There were famines that happened, pestilence that happened, but especially captivities. The three famous ones: the Assyrians captured the northern 10 tribes in 722 BC. The Babylonians captured the southern two tribes a century and a half later in 586 BC, and then, of course, the famous Roman captivity in AD 70 for the returnees from the Babylonian exile. They had built Jerusalem back up, and wham, it got wiped out and burnt to the ground by Titus in AD 70. So everything Joshua said came to pass. You disobey, you'll perish from the good land. And boy, the Israelites did disobey during the times of their history. Most of the bad stuff happened after the Israelites had conquered the land from the Euphrates to the Wadi al-Arish under Solomon. Things were moving upward in an upward direction, generally. They had their problems. They had their idolatry. The northern 10 tribes split from the southern tribes. And, of course, that happened after Solomon, I guess. But up until the time of Solomon, Solomon became the big dog in the ancient Near East. His kingdom was feared even by the Assyrians, by the Egyptians. And then the idolatry set in, and the degradation of Israel set in, to pretty soon they were wiped out, just as Joshua had predicted. You stay faithful, I'll bless you, I'll let you possess the land. You disobey, you're going to get kicked off the land, as well as suffering all kind of bad stuff. Now, Joshua says in verse 14, "Today I'm going the way of all the earth." He didn't mean he was going to die that very 24-hour day. He means in a short time he's going to die. He mentions in verse 14 that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed. It's all been fulfilled. We conquered the land just like he promised. He said that in a couple of chapters previous in Joshua 21, verse 45, "Not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. All came to pass." And again, I've already mentioned this, but note the implications for theology when we say that when Joshua says not one word has failed. John Gill points out not one word particularly concerning the good land had failed. And, of course, that was in Genesis 15. What is it, verse 18, I think it is, where God promised Abram all the land from the river Euphrates to the Wadi el-Arish. It had not failed. They basically had it. They had still some more conquering to do, more tribute to take, but they basically had it. In verse 15, Joshua pivots from the good news to the bad news. He says, "It shall come about that just as all the good words have come upon you, so the bad things, the threats, will come upon you if you disobey, till he has destroyed you." Just as. There's no difference. They're both words of God. Words of God that apply to obedience and words of God that apply to disobedience. God will fulfill his threats just as faithfully as he had fulfilled his promises. You will be destroyed, verse 15. That's according to the curses of the law. Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 68. I remember going through that and marveling at how nasty the stuff that was going to happen to them, especially when it got to scabies. Oh my gosh, I've had scabies. There's nothing worse. Oh my gosh. I actually told a pharmacist who said there was something wrong with the prescription I had for whatever drug it was I was using against scabies, and I'm sitting there scratching, I'm about to die. She said, "I'm sorry, I can't fill this prescription." And I looked at that pharmacist and I said, "Ma'am, if you do not give me the drugs that this prescription prescribes, I'm going to call Dr. Kevorkian, the death doctor, and I'm going to end it all." And she gave me the drugs. She realized I was serious. I'm telling you, that's some serious business scabies is. And so, a lot of stick here on the Israelites. God will destroy you when you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God and you serve other gods. Bad things happen. The anger of the Lord will burn against you, and you will perish quickly. Bye-bye. So long. Farewell. You're gone with the wind. You're never coming back again. Ladies and gentlemen, with those cheerful words, we have now finished Joshua's speech to the leaders of Israel in chapter 23. That prepares us to go on to chapter 24, which has 33 verses talking about the covenant renewal at Shechem and Joshua's death. We'll see you next time for that. Hope you enjoyed this audio.